Welcome to Earth Matters. This is Donna Stevens, Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance and your host for today's program on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM. Today's show is about citizen science, a welcome new trend in the field of science and research. And it's also about tiger beetles, especially western red-bellied tiger beetles. Joining me here in the studio is Sharman Apt Russell, who is the chairperson of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance Board of Directors and the author of several books, including her latest, Diary of a Citizen Scientist. And Sharman is also the world's leading authority on western red-bellied tiger beetles, and we'll be talking more about that later. Welcome, Sharman.
Welcome. Thank you.
Sharman, your most recent book, which just came out in September, is called Diary of a Citizen Scientist. And the subtitle, a bit long, is Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World. What is citizen science?
Well, you know, I use words like renaissance and revolution and transformation to describe it. So we've always had scientists who were not professionally trained, the untrained citizen. Darwin used a network of people who were helping him in his scientific research. Today, there's a lot more citizens, a lot more unprofessionally trained people working with scientists across all disciplines, you know, from physics to chemistry to certainly botany and biology and ornithology. I think the big thing about it today is the scale. So we have 200,000 people helping Cornell Lab of Ornithology monitor birds. We have almost a million people, you know, helping classify galaxies in Galaxy Zoo. So many people are doing it. That's that idea of crowdsourcing, that it's become really a movement of importance.
Why is there such a need for citizen science?
Well, there's partly, you know, a need just because people love to learn and love to grow and expand. And we're all, those of us doing citizen science, just find such deep satisfaction and pleasure in it. So there's that. There's ways of engaging the world, ways of transforming, ways of becoming, you know, a different person and learning new things about yourself. But the other need is, of course, environmental. You know, with there are big scale things happening to the planet in terms of climate change is one example, invasive species. So we need big scale, landscape-wide, continent-wide scientific research going on. And so now we're marshaling all those people to do it, you know, hundreds of thousands of people going out there and helping scientists look at things. Then the other thing that that does is create an educated public. So now more and more of us understand science and how it works and are getting involved in the natural world and passing that on to our children. A lot of citizen science is about education going into the schools. Mm-hmm. So I could go on and on. There's, you know, I think there's, you know, I just think it's a wonderful thing. I'm really a proselytizer. And of course, I think, you know, there's a great need.
Yeah, it seems like there's traditionally been such a gulf between the scientific community and the layperson, and the scientific community, not as much anymore, but they used to just kind of be talking to themselves and using all this terminology
jargon,
normal, not to say scientists aren't normal, of course, that most people couldn't understand. And so it's really good to have that gap kind of being bridged.
Yeah, there was really a trend towards specialization. And just as you say, and even within disciplines, there was all this specialization. So sometimes they weren't even talking to themselves very well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they woke up at one point, scientists in general, and said, we're not affecting public policy because the public doesn't even know what we're doing, and we haven't made a case of why they should care.
Yes.
And you know, particularly in the field of natural history, biology, you know, butterflies, birds, you know, streams. Again, for me, citizen science, one of the most powerful parts of it lies in how we're treating the environment and how citizen science is about what science can do for us, too. You know, because citizen mm-hmm. scientists are monitoring the health of their waters and their streams and their ponds and their lakes. They're looking at what kind of gases are in the air. They're looking at the natural world and they're seeing problems. And they're helping scientists really shape new policy.
I remember reading years ago about a woman in, I believe it was in Minnesota, and for about 40 years she kept records of when birds arrived in the spring and when they left again in the fall. And over all those years, this is just one woman keeping records, and at a certain point it began to be very important because she was documenting climate change. The birds arrived a couple weeks earlier in the spring, they left a couple weeks later in the fall, and, you know, these are birds that have been around for millions of years, and in just 40 years, which is long in a human lifespan but not very long in the evolution of a species,
Right. They
were changing their behavior. And this change over the years, well, it was attributed to climate change, and you talk about phenology in your book and how citizen scientists are working in this field. Can you talk about phenology, what it is, and what ordinary people are doing to further our knowledge in this area?
Yeah. That's a word I wish you could find another word for. You know, it's the study of life cycles. It's the study of how an organism changes through time and what it does through time. So for the tiger beetle, the phenology would be the egg, and then the three stages of the larva, and then the pupa, and then the adult tiger beetle. So, you know, it's life cycle. And that includes migration. You know, that includes what birds are doing in their life cycle. Includes when trees and plants leaf and when they flower and when they fruit. And actually, Thoreau also looked at birds, you know, back in the 19th century, and they're going back to his notebooks and including them as part of looking at climate change. There's a program called Nature's Notebook, which I'm engaged in and some other people in town, and it's asking thousands of Americans to go out in their backyard. They choose plants, they're on the lookout for certain animals, and they monitor their life cycles or their phenology over the years. And then that's all put in a national database. And so we're beginning to get this image of, you know, what is budding when, what is flowering when, what is fruiting when, all across the continent, really, all across America. And a few other projects are doing that, too. And that's a big-scale image of climate change.
So we can use historic writings, like you mentioned Thoreau, as kind of a baseline. This is what it was like before climate change.
We can. And also, we have like 30 years of data on cyclones. We're asking people to start deciphering the handwriting of World War I era Navy captains to look at weather. So we're also using this kind of crowdsourcing to go back into all these historical documents that are massive and to start, you know, organizing them and helping them look at, as you say, kind of a baseline. And, you know, what was happening in the 20th century, what was happening in the 19th century, and then, of course, what is happening in the 21st century.
Right. So to prepare for this interview, and also because I really, really enjoy your writing, I've been reading Diary of a Citizen Scientist. I'm about halfway through it. I just started a day or two ago. And in the book, you talk about a Will class, Western Institute for Lifelong Learning, a class that you taught called How to Become a Leading World Authority. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Yeah, I can. So when I was writing a book on butterflies, this was almost 10 years ago, I went to interview Dick Vainwright, who is the keeper of entomology at the London, you know, Natural Museum. And he gave a quote that stayed with me for a decade. He said, "You could choose any obscure insect, and within a week, you would know more than anyone else on the planet." So he was trying to talk about how, you know, how many things there are out there to discover, particularly, you know, with obscure insects and plants and things that we humans don't care about that much. I mean, millions and millions of species, and how quickly you could become an expert. Now, Dick really meant if you are an entomologist, you could take a week. But I kind of ran with that and kept thinking about it and kind of used it as a center to this book. And then it was kind of funny. I thought, well, there must be all these people who want to become leading authorities on things, playing into our vanity and our human nature and, you know, making it a joke, too. So I had a Will class in this. Well, three people came. So that was kind of a funny moment. However, Alison Boyd was one of those people. Ed Greenberg was one of those people. They've both gone on to do exciting and interesting things, as they always have in our community. So that was kind of funny. It was a small club of leading world authorities.
Only
on nothing
three?
In particular. Yes.
Only three in this area? Come
only
on,
three.
People. Become a leading world authority.
Well, I have to say we do have a number of leading world authorities. Russ Kleinman is now the leading world authority on flora in the Gila, you know, forest. And he's certainly a citizen scientist. He wasn't trained in botany. He was trained in other fields. And we have others, citizen scientists who have excelled.
So. Right. I remember going on field trips with Russ Kleinman, and I knew more plants than he did, but that is certainly not the case anymore.
I
he knows it all now.
That's that transformative thing. That's that renaissance of people, you know, suddenly you're a dentist and you become an expert as a lepidopterist. And,
right.
And that's also about there's so much to know and discover, certainly in this area and in every area across the world.
Yeah, there is a lot to know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I guess if you just pick one little thing and really focus on it, you can become the...
A leading world authority.
Right. And it sounds so impressive, doesn't it?
It sounds like fun, yeah.
And it is fun, apparently.
It's lots of fun.
So I wanted to tell you that you probably have heard this, but one of my all-time favorite science quotes comes from geneticist and evolutionary biologist J.B.S. Haldane. And years ago, I read that Haldane was asked by theologians if there was anything he could conclude about the Creator from studying the creation of the universe. And Haldane replied that God has an inordinate fondness for beetles. Which just really cracked me up then and still does. And this is because there's more species of beetles than any other insect in the world, and there's more insects than any other animal. There are some really great beetle photos in your book, Charmin, and I kept looking at them. They're very close up. And I kept looking at them to see, have I ever seen a tiger beetle? And I like beetles, and I pay attention to them if they're in my path, and I certainly don't step on them, but I don't know that I've ever seen a tiger beetle. And so I have to say then, too, that as I was reading your book, I kept coming back to this one fundamental question. Why? Like, why tiger
why?
Beetles? And what piqued your interest in tiger beetles?
Okay, right. Well, you know, one of the fun things about writing is how much serendipity is involved. So I emailed David Pearson, who's a world expert in tiger beetles, mainly because he's also an advocate for citizen scientists. He really believes if especially conservation biologists don't pay attention to the public, then they're not going to have any influence in policy. So I emailed him just kind of a general entree, you know, saying I was thinking of a book on this subject. And he emailed me back that afternoon, and he already had some tiger beetles he wanted me to go look at. He was already, you know, urging me to get out in the field. I started doing that. I went to Lake of the Dog over in eastern New Mexico, and I went to the Rio Grande. He's the co-author of Tiger Beetles of the United States and Canada. And in that big map of tiger beetles, there are a few blank spots. And so I chose one of those, which is the western red-bellied tiger beetle, which larval biology unknown. But the other serendipity part, of course, is that tiger beetles are really amazing. And like you, I thought I had never seen one before. But in fact, when you go to the Gila River, you see them all over. You just don't know what you're seeing. They're very small, you know, a quarter, a third of an inch. They're skittering around on the sand. And from our, you know, giant proportions, we just think they're little sandflies. We just think they're little tiny skittery insects around on the sand. At times, there are hundreds of them, thousands of them swarming the riverbank. And then when you look closely at them, as you've seen in the book, they're extraordinary. I mean, they have these huge mandibles and they're fierce.
Okay. We're going to talk some more about tiger beetles, so please stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. If you're just joining us, I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your host for today's program. With me today in the studio is writer Sharman Apt Russell, who is the world's leading authority on Western red-bellied tiger beetles. And we're talking about beetles, of course, and also citizen science. So you started telling us before the break, when I said, I'm not sure if I've ever seen a tiger beetle, you were assuring me that I have, but just didn't know that that's what it was. So in your book, the pictures are so great, and they look huge and fierce, but they're really only a quarter of an inch long.
Right, right.
Okay, so they'd be pretty easy to overlook unless you were really paying attention.
Right.
And, I mean, that's a great deal of science, and citizen science is paying attention.
Absolutely. It's a great excuse to pay attention to be kind of awake in the world, to be alert.
So why is it important to know more about tiger beetles?
Well, let's see. I'm pausing at that. I think it does go back to being awake in the world, to being alert in the world. You know, it's important for us to do that in general, to be aware of beetles and flies and microbes and bacteria and soil and ecosystems and ecology. I mean, as you go up, you just get that larger scale, and you of course, that's the scale we live at, and it's all important. Tiger beetles are also what we call biomarkers. So in places where there are lots of tiger beetles are everywhere in the world. There's, you know, some 3,000 species. In places where there's a diversity and abundance of tiger beetles, there's almost always a diversity and abundance of birds and butterflies, too. So
okay.
Sometimes when they're assessing an area, you know, a national park, they will just go in and monitor the tiger beetles. And that's a biomarker that tells you, oh, yeah, this is a pretty healthy place.
Okay. If you see a large numbers of tiger beetles or a diversity of species?
Yeah,
or both.
Both,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I remember being – I'm kind of an amateur botanist, and I remember being out on the Gila River years ago with a group of students and saying, okay, now let's go look over there. And somebody said to me, do you have really good eyesight? And I said, no. I don't have very good eyesight, but I've kind of developed a search image. Like, I see that shrub over there has different colored leaves than what we're looking at here. So we just went over there, and sure enough, it was something we hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what you do with tiger beetles as well.
You do. You develop a search engine and a sense of them, and you, of course, get into their psyche and their personality, and you know
really?
What tiger beetles like and what kind of food they want and their favorite movie star.
Who are their favorite movie stars?
Oh, and Schwarzenegger. Arnold
Schwarzenegger
for sure.
Huh. I was going to say, the beetles, but that's too obvious.
The Terminator. The tiger beetle is kind of a Terminator insect.
Really? In what sense?
Well, they're one of the fastest insects in the world. There's an Australian tiger beetle that can run over 5 miles an hour.
Wow.
They have these giant mouth parts. They run after their victim. They grab, they stab, they drench them with digestive juices, and then they suck out the puree in their mouth parts. And that's the adult. And the larvae are equally ferocious. The larvae kind of are little grubs, but the little grubs also have those mouth parts that are grabbing, stabbing tools. And they have little back hooks which anchor them in the tunnel, and they kind of lunge out of their tunnel anchored. They lunge out like these B-movie monsters and grab their prey and then whip back in the tunnel. So, you know, it's a wonderful world. If you fall in love with mountain lions, you know, you may only see a mountain lion a few times in your life. If you fall in love with tiger beetles, you're going to get to see this kind of drama all the time.
It's just a little drama.
Well,
I mean, it's a big drama,
right.
But it's a tiny scale.
It's the scale, yeah.
So you just have to get down on the ground and look.
You do.
Sit there and pay attention.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you started to talk before the break a little bit about the life cycle of beetles, and I wonder if you could tell us what is their life cycle? What do they do?
Yeah. Well, you know, the female tiger beetle, western red-bellied tiger beetle, goes off somewhere, and we still don't know where. And that was my job, to find out where does she lay her eggs and what kind of habitat. And my joke is that there's 3 million acres of the Gila National Forest, so if I take 1 million a year, this is a 3-year study, because
right.
I really haven't found it yet.
You better get to work.
I know. I've got a lot of walking to do. So she lays her eggs. The eggs hatch. The tiny, tiny larvae burrow down, usually vertically in soil. They start eating. They grab their tiny, tiny little prey, and they molt into three instars, or kind of like kind of like three grubs, three caterpillars, first, second, third. They're each getting, each time it's getting bigger, the larva enlarging its burrow. Finally, it pupates, and then the from that emerges as the adult tiger beetle.
And pupates, again, means for those of us who haven't been in high school biology for 30 years, pupate means what?
It's a miracle. I think you just need to know that. It's just like the caterpillar of the butterfly. It forms a kind of encasing that protects it. And all these hormones switch around and body parts switch around. And that grub inside that pupa metamorphosizes into a beetle. Looks totally different, a totally different looking kind of creature, just like the butterfly looks totally different from the caterpillar.
That does seem like a miracle.
I mean,
don't you wish you could do that sometimes? Like tomorrow you emerge as a totally different life form?
Who knows? I'm not saying that you heard about it first on this program, but if there are
rumors, you are the world's leading authority.
That's right. I did morph into that.
So if someone out there in radio land is inspired after listening to you, and I'm sure someone will be, where would they look to find a western red-bellied tiger beetle? So in what kinds of habitats do they occur? You've said that they are along the banks of the Gila River.
A lot along the banks of the Gila River, along any water source, really, irrigation ditches, ponds, lakes. This is one of the few species that comes out before the rains. So you'll see them in June, in early June and throughout June, and then throughout the summer, congregating around water sources. And they're so predaceous, they'll often be kind of attacking helpless dying organisms around the pond or the ditch or the river.
Yeah. Do they have red bellies? An obvious kind of question.
Yes. They have orangish-red abdomens. So when they fly up, you can see that. And that indicates, as it often does, that they're bad-tasting, that they that they emit some poisonous chemicals.
Right. So like brightly colored animals, frogs, or insects or whatever, if they're being that obvious, they're saying, I'm bad, leave me alone.
Right. Yeah. I'm too obvious for you to eat.
Right. So I think it would be very difficult to observe them going through their three instars and then pupating in the wild. So you did something different so that you could witness this in the comfort of your own home.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, the first thing I had to do was collect them and, with my long-handled net and you kind of these Tai Chi movements of stalking. They're very fast and they're very alert. So you really have to learn, the approach to them. And it's not that easy. And so collecting them, putting them in terrariums, feeding them little mini mealworms. And then when they did oviposit and when the eggs did hatch into larvae, which only one other scientist had ever done. Again, you're always kind of like the first. I'm the first to have my western red-bellied females lay eggs. I'm the first to see this instar. I'm the first to see this second instar. So, I was probably not the first on the planet since there were plenty of people before, we came to Arizona, New Mexico. There were plenty of other people who probably saw these too, but the first to document them anyways.
Right.
And then you had to feed the little larva and cut up your little mini mealworms and halves and quarters. And, that was part of it.
And did you feed them to them? Did you put them in front of the hole where they were burrowed or did you just put them on the ground? And
tiger beetle larvae will learn to anticipate your feeding and they will come to the top of the burrow where they are mostly anyways and kind of wait for mama to come with the forceps and give them the mini mealworm, which they will take out of your forceps and eat.
You mean they kind of knew what time of the day you fed them and they'd be there waiting?
That's probably not true.
Oh,
but
okay.
They're always waiting. But that's what it seems
they're always
like.
Waiting.
That's what it began to seem like. They also start taking prey down and kind of catching it and then coming back for more. So
if you weren't feeding them mealworms, if they were out in the wild, would they be waiting for an insect to come by?
Right.
Some tiny thing that's way tinier than them?
Exactly. And so it shows you how many tiny things are out there. Tiny ants, tiny spiders. Yeah. Because they're totally carnivorous. They are not going to eat a piece of pumpkin pie.
Okay. Good to know. So those pictures of the larvae in your book were they were fierce looking. I've never seen anything quite like that.
Right.
It looked like a dragon, honestly. It just reminded me of a dragon.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I know. They're wonderful.
But you didn't know anything about tiger beetles
before
you embarked on this adventure.
I really didn't. You know, I had written about butterflies. I had written about pollination ecology. You know, I have a background in science. But that's what Dick Vainwright was saying. There's so much we don't know. You know, mm-hmm. you could just look around at any square inch of dirt and you'd find something you never knew anything about and no one else had either.
Yeah. So how long did you study tiger beetles?
Well, the book covers two field seasons, two summers. And, of course, I've continued since then. And so it's ongoing.
Are they good pets?
No.
No.
You know,
I didn't think so.
Anything you have to cut up a mini mealworm for.
Well, they're not very affectionate, right?
They're not very affectionate.
Yeah. What did you learn as a tiger beetle kind of surrogate mom?
Well, I learned a lot of things. You know, I noticed this with butterflies, too, and it's also in the literature. Insects are not little robots. Each one has its own kind of life experience. I saw some tiger beetles that were so aggressive, just as when they've done memory experiments with butterflies, individual butterflies can do better, you know, than others. So that's a good reminder. The world is not a computer. It's not a mechanical thing.
Right.
You know, the other thing I learned being a citizen scientist in general is why I never became a scientist. It's very tedious. There's all this detail work you have to do. You have to write down everything and keep charts. And you know, I'm not that detail-oriented. So you learn a lot about the subject. You learn a lot about general ecology. And then you learn a lot about yourself. What could be more fun?
What did you learn about yourself, if that's not too personal of a question?
I'm afraid it. Well, again, I learned why I didn't become a scientist. I learned I don't have the patience for that kind of work. I also had, of course, as I suspected, romanticized being a field biologist and the bliss, the rapture, sun-kissed, plant-besotted, you know, at one
right.
with nature, when in fact you're kind of bored and hot and
yeah.
there are flies and
yeah.
things like that. So that's always good to remind yourself about.
Well, that's one thing that I thought reading your book is that it seemed like you did have an enormous amount of patience, and that picture on the cover of you striding determinedly across the plain with your,
yes.
you know, across the floodplain with your net, it looked to me like you did have the patience to do this.
Well, you know, above all, I have the patience to write books, and I will do what I need to do to be a writer.
That's pretty amazing to have that kind of patience. So please stay with us. We'll be right back with Earth Matters after this break. Welcome back to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance and your host for today's program. Joining me today in the studio is Sharman Apt Russell, the author of several books, including An Obsession with Butterflies, Anatomy of a Rose, and Hunger, an Unnatural History, among others. We're talking about citizen science and tiger beetles. Sharman, I wanted to ask you if there are any, we've talked about some kind of the national programs like Nature Network, was it called?
Nature's Notebook.
And you said Cornell Lab of Ornithology has
yeah.
200,000 volunteers yeah. nationwide, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But people like birds, right?
they
usually like birds better than tiger beetles. So I wanted to ask you, what kinds of citizen science efforts are happening locally right here in southwest New Mexico?
Yeah, yeah. And really the book is a celebration of the whole field because there is so much happening. There's so much going on. So a few other of the ones I'm involved with, one is the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. I think Nathan Newcomer has maybe as many as 40 volunteers. Wow. People going out and inventorying areas in the Gila National Forest that are potential candidates for future wilderness. There's also a program I'm involved with, the New Mexico Site Steward. And I did that just this last weekend. We have archaeological sites that we go and look at periodically for any damage. So again, part of this is environmental activism, but it's also about science. It's also about helping people keep track of things. So there's those two local programs. There's people involved in Nature's Notebook here, involved in Audubon Bird Count, involved in all these online programs that use crowdsourcing, as I talked about. The world has millions and millions of images now, just kind of raw data that people need to sort through, you know, whether that be from pictures of Mars, from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, or whether that be these ship logs I was talking about from World War I era Navy captains, or, you know, Egyptian fragments, you know, that people need to look at to see what the hieroglyphics are saying. So there's all this work to do. Out in the Gila Valley, Katie Skaggs, as a high school teacher, has about over 20 years of data of students going out and looking at the doing water analysis of the river and checking, and that she puts on a statewide database. So I took mastodon matrix, which is where school children look through the matrix of a mastodon excavated few years ago. It's a 10,000-year-old mastodon, and they're actually looking through all the soil surrounding that mastodon and finding bits of seeds and finding leaves and finding twigs and finding rocks, and that's helping develop an image of what the environment was like around that mastodon. So you know, 3,000 school children have done that, including children here in Deming and, you know, the Silver City area. So there's so much going on.
I remember in somewhere in your book you said, is this really science, or is it science education or science PR? Can you talk about that? Is it really science?
Yeah, right, right.
Or is it science light?
Yes, you know? Right. It's all of that. You know, certainly okay. Having these Deming school children, you know, look through this mastodon matrix, you know, these are not miniature paleontologists. You know, they were dropping their little clamshells on the floor and right. They were, you know, sitting on the, you know, the jar that had rocks in it. And they were, right. You know, on the other hand, with all these kids doing it across the country, their accumulated data came up with more taxa, more unusual, more species of plants in those soil samples than a small study done by actual scientists, because there's just more of them. Even if they make mistakes, there's more of them. Right. Now, that was clearly education, which is pretty important.
Okay. Yes.
There's also a few projects that you might call science light, which again might be more education. You know, there's some projects which you might clearly say are environmental activism. But then there's a lot of projects which are real science. And so there's a program called Fold It, in which all these video gamers, and I think there's about 600,000 participants in this program over the years, these video gamers go through this process in which they look at the different ways that amino acids combine and recombine. And, you know, they're just very good visually and spatially, and they're coming up with all these different designs. So they address a problem that these biochemists put to them. They're trying to synthesize new proteins, and they succeed. And the biochemists in this program say, you know, I looked for 2 years to try and find a new way to synthesize this protein. Fold It came up with it. You know, these video gamers came up with it, and I still don't know how they did it. You know, human mind's so creative. When you get 1,000 of us to do something, when you get 10,000 of us to do something, when you get 100,000 of us to do something, when you get 1,000,000 of us to do something and engage our creative minds, yeah, real science gets done.
That's cool, because, I mean, I know that for myself anyway, I always feel like I'm limited to the ideas that my own brain generates. And if I have somebody else with me, their brain is different and they come up with different things.
Exactly, so. Yeah. And let me just add that in addition, there are people like Bill Neely and Russ Kleinman and other citizen scientists who really do become very expert and who really just kind of switch fields in a way.
Yeah, I think you just have to decide what you're interested in and pick one thing.
Yeah.
And then you can become the world's leading authority.
Moi, look at me.
Right, look at you. I'm sitting in the studio with the world's leading authority on Western red-bellied tiger beetles. Who'd have thunk it? There was also, you talked about Nathan Newcomer from the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance leading these efforts to go out and inventory areas that could be added to the wilderness system. I've gone out with Nathan and with a group of people doing this a few times, and it's super fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it is not work. It's fun.
Right.
And you get to, you know, just Nathan gives you an assignment. You go to this place that you've maybe never been to before and look at it with different eyes than you normally would if you're just going for a hike. But it basically is going for a hike.
Yeah.
It's just a good excuse to get out there. And then we've talked a little bit before about the nonprofit Sky Island Alliance based in Tucson and the kind of work that they're doing here in our area. Can you talk about that?
Sure, sure. And I went on a trip with them to look at tracks. So Sky Island Alliance has a number of, it's called wildlife linkages, and they're looking at where the wildlife are, what corridors they're using, where they are in Arizona and now New Mexico. And that helps them work with people who are doing human development. So, for example, in Arizona, that's really meant that Sky Island Alliance has gone to the table with people from the county, people from the transportation department, people from the city. They're saying, here there's, you know, quite a lot of predators, keystone species here. We know where the wildlife are. You need to make your roads, and you need to do some wildlife overpasses, underpasses.
Right.
You need to develop a certain way. And people are receptive to that more and more. So here in the boroughs is one of the first such teams that's looking at a particular transect in the boroughs. And, you know, I have a friend there, Sonny, who works on that and who writes about it. And it's just like there's so many bears out there. There's so many mountain lions out there. There's so many wonderful animals out there. We don't see them, but we can see their tracks if we're alert and we know what we're looking for. And that's pretty neat.
And there's also a young man here locally, Jess DeMoss, who has put a wildlife camera in that area. And I've seen the pictures, and, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there's a bear strolling down Bar Six Canyon. And I think of how many times I've been out there at 3 in the afternoon.
I know.
I never saw a bear.
He has a wonderful footage in which you're looking at that, and then the bear comes closer. And then suddenly the whole tree goes black because the bear is just kind of says, oh my gosh, what is this funny thing in the tree?
Right.
And it's trying to brush it off. And then the screen goes, you know, returns, and there's this little eye at the corner of the screen, and then the bear ambles away.
Right. I saw that photo sequence. It was really funny.
It is funny.
And then he captured deer during the day. I mean, on camera, captured deer and skunks and, you know, some of the more common stuff. But I just think it's fascinating to see those photos and to see what's out there that we just aren't seeing because we make too much noise.
Right.
So we just go away.
We have people going out there and some people who haven't been out that much in the Gila National Forest. This is their entrance into it. We have actual science getting done. Now we know more about, you know, the wildlife in our area. And we have actual effect on public policy. So it's just, it works on so many different levels.
Yeah, and I think what you were saying earlier about talking to the Department of Transportation in Arizona and New Mexico, and they're adjusting where they would build the road, you know, and building overpasses or underpasses for wildlife.
Absolutely.
I think that stuff's important. A couple of weeks ago, I was out on the Gila River. This is completely unrelated to roads, really, but I was out on the Gila River with some people who are looking at what could be done to fix the Gila River at the Highway 180 bridge. And there were a lot of Department of Transportation people there. And one of them was telling me, you know, all of these roads were built so long ago. And he particularly mentioned the one over the Black Range, Highway 152. And he said, we're just stuck with these roads. And some of them aren't well situated. So here's this road that used to be a wagon trail, and now it's a paved road. And now the Department of Transportation has it, and we have to try and make it less harmful to wildlife somehow.
Right.
So that's the kind of work that citizen science is involved in.
They can, we're, you know, lots of eyes, lots of brain power, lots of work, you know, being done by lots of people.
So we've talked about a few areas that seemed kind of tangible to me, the things that people were doing when they did citizen science. But there was something in your book about a galaxy project, people looking at galaxies, and that was a bit confusing to me. So what are these people really doing?
So Galaxy Zoo started in 2007, and there was this astrophysicist in England, and he had a theory that new stars could form in young galaxies, spiral-shaped, as well as old galaxies that are elliptical. But in order to prove his theory and multiply this by many astronomer theories, you need sample sizes. He needed a huge sample of spiral-shaped galaxies and a huge sample of elliptical-shaped galaxies. He had 1 million images from a telescope in New Mexico. You have to classify these with the human eye and brain because we're actually better at doing that than computers. You can't just give this to a software program. So what he started is this online program in which people go online and they're trained, which is very short training, to classify galaxies. So this is a spiral, this is elliptical. It gets more and more complicated. How many arms does it have? What do you see here? What do you see there? But you have human eyes now looking at these millions and millions and millions of images that are being taken by the Hubble telescope, that are being taken by our telescopes here on Earth, that are overwhelming the small number of professional astronomers we have. Uh-huh. Galaxy Zoo has become so successful. I mean, if you go online and classify a galaxy and give information about it, that's corroborated by 30 other volunteers. So that kind of redundancy gives them an accuracy that's equal to professional astronomers. So this has exploded. So now suddenly these astronomers have all these sample sizes. They have all this information they didn't have before. Astronomers associated with Galaxy Zoo get more time on telescopes because they're writing all these papers and getting all this information. We have possibly 500 billion galaxies in the universe. Citizen scientists are now helping kind of map the universe by classifying those galaxies. In the first year, they classified 50 million. Today, it's much more.
And so this is something people do in the comfort of their own home. They don't have to go trekking around, getting dirty and cold.
There's a wonderful clearinghouse of citizen science project. It's called SciStarter, SciStarter. And if you Google that, you can find out where the citizen science projects are, the comfort of your home, a nearby stream, what to do in winter, what to do in summer, what to do with kids.
Very good. We'll talk some more about that after the break. Stay with us, please. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. With Donna Stevens, that's me, your host for today's show, and joining me in the studio is writer Sharman Apt Russell. And we're talking about Sharman's interest in citizen science, which is a rising trend, which led her to really grand adventures in raising Western red-bellied tiger beetles. Yes, raising tiger beetles. I wanted to go back to ask you a question about tiger beetles. You said that your book covers two seasons of raising and exploring tiger beetles, and you said you're still doing something with them. What are you still doing with tiger beetles? You still have some in your house?
Oh, not last summer, the summer before. Mainly I need to be outside finding their larval burrow holes. Barry Nicely and I, he's one of the co-authors of the Tiger Beetle Guide to the United States and Canada, came up with a theory about where and when the tiger beetles would lay their eggs. I have to tell you, Donna, that this involved me dissecting the ovaries of female tiger beetles throughout the summer. Yes, they're very tidy.
Yeah, I guess.
And so that, you know, new depth and height in citizen science for me anyways. And after doing that, it turns out Barry's theory and mine was completely wrong. We're absolutely wrong. Mm-hmm. And that was really a wonderful moment. That kind of brought you back to those science fair projects in grade school where you have a testable hypothesis. It's right or it's wrong. And science is about proving something wrong as much as it is about proving something right.
Yeah.
So based on that, we think the tiger beetle females fly off probably at least up to a half a mile away from the riverbank and lay their eggs throughout the summer. They don't wait to the end of the season and then disperse and lay them even farther away. So again, about a half mile, maybe farther from the riverbank somewhere. And it's, you know, my job to go find out where. So I'm still doing that.
These are really microscopic
holes. These are really small little holes. It's definitely a mystery. And again, the tiger beetle experts, and we're all kind of joking about me being authority. But of course, as I said at the beginning, you have to be an entomologist to become a real authority. But I know a lot more than most people know about Western red-bellied tiger beetles, a lot more than a few entomologists know, but I don't have their depth of knowledge. But Barry and David Pearson, who do have a great depth of knowledge, also find it odd and mysterious because the Western red-bellied tiger beetle is so abundant. I mean, really, thousands will be swarming the Gila Bird Refuge area, you know, at the right time. So where are their burrow holes? We don't know.
And how did you prove Barry wrong? What when you you dissected the female's ovaries, what did you learn?
Well, what we learned is that their eggs were maturing all throughout the season. We had thought that we would find large eggs towards the end of the season, and a large egg is a sign it's about to be laid, about its pre-oviposition. Instead, we found a range of sizes and of eggs early in the season all throughout.
Mm-hmm. And then you said that these tiger beetles are active before it starts to rain, so before the monsoons come
on.
Right,
they come out in June.
And then once it starts to rain, what happens?
Well, the Gila River will flood, and their habitat will be flooded, and then it will, of course, here recede, and then they'll come back. So they're staying around through end of August.
Okay, so that's the reason they lay their eggs about maybe half a mile from the river, is they don't want the eggs to all flood?
That was our theory. However, the oscillated tiger beetle does lay its eggs close to the river, and there are tiger beetles whose larvae can survive in burrows that are flooded for, you know, a few days. There's ones in the Amazon that can do it for a few months. So, again, you can't come up with quick conclusions in science. It's so diverse. There's such a range of responses to the world, and you have to be prepared for surprises and to actually test it, not just assume it.
Right. And then you kind of build on the knowledge that other people have, and they stand on your shoulders and learn more.
Someday,
and it just goes on and on.
Will stand on my shoulders and say, she learned this about the Western red-bellied tiger beetle.
Right. And I've learned this.
And
now
I've learned
I'm
that.
The world's leading authority.
Right.
You've talked a little bit about how people can get involved with citizen science, and that website again was SciStarter.
SciStarter. So SCI Starter.
Okay, and then they can learn about all these other kinds of projects that you were talking about, the galaxies.
Yeah, Darlene Cavalier started that, and I'm going to be working with her on a new project I'm kind of excited about. But her idea is to bring together not just the major projects, but all the small and local ones too. So you would plug in New Mexico, or you would plug in what kind of project you wanted. You would plug in cost. Most of these projects are free. A few of them you have to spend kind of a minimum amount of money on. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a way for anyone to go online and kind of find the project in their area, in their interest.
I remember that just reminded me of something I read in your book, which I thought was really funny and also very encouraging. And it was about women who had previously, or maybe still are, professional cheerleaders who are also PhD scientists. Can you talk about that? I found that fascinating,
Darlene,
frankly.
Actually was a cheerleader for the, I forget what team, you know, and then she went on in this other field. But yes, it's cheerleaders for science, and it's very, it's culturally telling, you know, that we'll read someone is a cheerleader for the Houston Rockets and is now working as a biochemist for Johns Hopkins. So, you know, yes, all these women have either present or past experience as professional cheerleaders for professional teams, and then, of course, went on to do something in the sciences. And it's an organization that's going out to, I don't know, some million young women in the world who cheerlead and say, look, science, math, careers, you know, you can have it all.
Right. I mean, I think we tend to have the stereotype of kind of a bubble-headed blonde who's out there, you know, shaking her butt for the Dallas Cowboys or something. But there's something going on inside that brain, huh?
That's an assertive, you know, young woman who's doing what she wants to do.
That's cool. I really liked that idea. So we just have a few minutes left in the program today, Sharman, and I want to make sure that you get in some readings, some excerpts from your book, because I really liked it. I'm still really enjoying reading it.
Okay.
So well, go for it.
All right. I'll read a few. I want to also say that a number of the wonderful photographs in this book were taken by Elroy Limmer, our fantastic photographer of close-ups, insects, and plants, and also by Dennis Weller, some wonderful landscapes. Mm-hmm. And the book, I do try and be funny in the book.
The book is
an effort of humor and also there's a fair amount of philosophy. So I will read because there's time to philosophize while you're bored and stupefied out in the outdoors waiting for a beetle to do something.
Right.
So here's one of the later passages, August 25th, 2012. Where an arroyo meets the dirt road, I stop and look for tracks. A few feet up the stream bed are a nice set of bobcat prints. There's no mistaking that roundness, the leading toe, the size of the front and back feet. I also see a fox print, or maybe a small coyote. Foxes are on my mind since I saw three earlier in the day, probably a mother and two kits, who ran so quickly into the brush I spent a few minutes questioning what I had seen. Was that a fox or a wish? That's one good thing about tracks. They stay there. You can admire them for long minutes, imagining the animal who passed by, feeling the tangible presence of a bobcat, short-tailed, tufted-eared, delicately spotted, charismatic, predatory. It's another gift, the world showering us with gifts. The tail of a fox, tracks in the sand, and there, growing up in the shadowed bank of this arroyo, a mound of jimson weed, also called moonflower, also called thorn apple, also called sacred datura, the large, creamy, lavender-tinted, trumpet-shaped blossoms seeming to glow, exuding power and a rich scent. Is all this for me? I feel the need to fall in love with the world, to forge that relationship ever more strongly. But maybe I don't have to work so hard. I have thought my nature indifferent to humans, to one more human, but maybe the reverse is true. Maybe the world is already in love, giving me these gifts all the time, calling out all the time, take this and this and this, don't turn away. And here's my car, too, at the end of the road, the end of this field season, my second summer chasing tiger beetles. My day pack clatters with glass vials for the beetles I didn't find, and once again, no different today, I didn't discover any hidden or neglected talent. I didn't transform into someone I am not. But I am building on existing strengths. I've always been good at skittering and darting on the surface of things, adding a few animal tracks to the few birds I know and the few butterflies and the few plants. And I've always been good at walking a country road and seeing for a nanosecond something shivery and grand. Requited love. I am the bride of the world, and I am the groom.
That's great. It's funny that you picked that passage because that is just really one of my favorite parts of the book. It's just that right there. And we have a couple more minutes. Do you have another one you'd like to read for us?
Sure. Okay. And this one may be more to do with tiger beetles. This is one I've just recognized, an oscillated tiger beetle, and it's also common here. It's called the house finch of tiger beetles, as a matter of fact. It has four creamy dots. Pattern recognition, four creamy dots. Something in the world and something in my brain snap into place like the two ends of a tinker toy. Tiger beetle and butterfly enthusiasts share this satisfaction, matching up beauty with order. Chevrons, bands, circles, dots. We can identify some species fairly quickly. The mind has a picture. The picture matches. The square peg goes into the square hole. Birders also know that pleasure, a flash of color and form, and they have an answer, scrub jay or vermilion flycatcher. This kind of competence feels completely right. It's as if we belonged here, as if nature were our real home.
That's lovely. I wanted to thank you so much, Sharman, for joining me to talk about citizen science here today. And we've given people some ideas of where they could go to plug into this whole movement. And thanks for talking about Western red-bellied tiger beetles, which I didn't even know existed until you started writing about them, and other new ways of engaging the world. And I want to thank our audio engineer and Kuru guru, Kyle Johnson, and thank you for tuning in to this week's program. I'm Donna Stevens. Please join us next week for another edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU, at 89.1 FM.